Hello, good afternoon, everyone. So I would just first like to start off thanking the committee for allowing me to come back down here. It's always a privilege to be able to speak to this group. It's always an excellent symposium, and I hope you all get a lot of great information. The morning speakers were fabulous, as always. So, as John said, I'm here to speak to you a little bit about concussion and some topics that people really haven't done a lot of research on. So when we think about concussion, most people think about with their baseline testing, doing cognitive testing or neurocognitive testing using any kind of baseline measures with computers or paper and pencil, and then doing balance and potentially bringing in some vision. How many of you have had athletes who were able to get back at their baseline and they said, and their doctor said, that they should be able to return to play? However, even though they were back at baseline or the same or similar levels, they were different. They weren't right, and you knew that they probably shouldn't go back. Anybody? Has anybody ever had that happen? Lots. That happens a lot, right? And so there are lots of other things that we need to think about, and some of this emotion dysregulation that I'm going to talk about today, I think maybe is something that we need to consider kind of including with what we're doing. So when we think about concussions, you need to understand that it's a multifaceted injury and that there are so many different aspects to concussion, not just one, and that not one single one of these aspects is more important than the other. They all have equal weight. And kind of like they said this morning, you know, when you're looking at the big competition and you let people go a little bit earlier than maybe they should, concussion is one of those things where you should just keep it even keel all the time and have the same kind of perspective and same kind of cut points and return to play no matter what the situation is. And understanding that vision, cognition, balance, those aren't the only three aspects that can play into how somebody presents and what we need to look at in our initial injury, as well as they're returning and recovering, and then we're looking at our return to play. So when we think about a traumatic brain injury, and the literature isn't necessarily always clear on this, so I'd like to clear this up a little bit. Traumatic brain injury, if you speak to an emergency room physician, is different and more significant than what we see as athletic trainers on the sideline. A sport-related concussion, if you look at traumatic brain injury, it's this big overarching umbrella. And sport-related concussions are way far off on the far side. When they talk about traumatic brain injury, an emergency room physician is talking about gunshot wounds, car accidents, major falls where people have brain bleeds and skull fractures, and maybe never recover completely. Whereas with sport-related concussion, most of our athletes, regardless of age, are better in 2 weeks, maybe three if they're really young and it was significant, right? And with traumatic brain injury, most of these individuals only have one ever in their lifetime. How many of you have had athletes that have more than one playing sports at your university or high school? Probably everybody should raise your hand in the room. If you don't, I need to come work at your school because you are very special. Or maybe I shouldn't because I wouldn't get any research done because I need people with multiple concussions for some of my stuff. But truth be told, this is something that's a little bit different. Our recovery, the mechanisms, everything's different. So when we look at traumatic brain injury research, make sure as you read this that it is something different. The mechanisms are different, their recovery period is different, and so make sure that you're understanding that. So when we look at mild cognitive impairment, and this is something that develops in the normative population, you don't have to have sports in your history to develop mild cognitive impairment. But those individuals who have moderate to severe traumatic brain injuries are at a greater rate or more likely to develop mild cognitive impairment than individuals who have never sustained a traumatic brain injury. What we found in sport-related concussion research is individuals who have had three or more sport-related concussions at any point in time during their history are more likely to develop mild cognitive impairment as well. This research, I will let you know, has only been conducted thus far with retired NFL athletes. This has never been done with people who've only played in college or only played in high school or junior high or club sports. This is only professional athletes. Do most of us act, look, or play like professional football players? I would say 99.9% of all the athletes I've ever dealt with will never be at that level, as will basically everybody else. When we think about Alzheimer's disease, and usually MCI is a precursor to Alzheimer's disease, we see very similar patterns where if you have a traumatic brain injury, you have a much higher odds of developing Alzheimer's disease. When we look at sport-related concussions, you're not at a higher odds or more likely to develop it, but what they see is that actually it occurs earlier in your lifespan. So when we're comparing them to individuals who haven't had three or more sport-related concussions, the same number of people get it, but they just get it earlier. And again, I would like to point out that this research has only been conducted with retired NFL athletes. So again, not college, not high school, not junior high only athletes. So again, this is a separate set, a different group of people who have much higher repetition and higher forces going through. That's not to say that it won't pertain to everybody, but it's just kind of something to keep in the back of your mind. Finally, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, also known as CTE, is something that's been in the media a lot over the last couple of years. And this is something, there's a lot of debate and discussion over CTE and its existence and how it presents and what causes it. And so the thing that is interesting is thus far, all of the research has only been done with athletes. This is the only injury really where they're only truly looking in athletic brains for this. But the interesting thing is that all of these have very similar presentations from emotion dysregulation, where we're looking at increased depression, anxiety, aggression, impulsivity, with CTE and sometimes with the others, including Parkinson's, suicidality, violent behaviors. If any of you have ever dealt with an elder parent or family member that's had Alzheimer's disease, sometimes they'll get violent and lash out. So what we see are some of these kind of coming together of their signs and symptoms. So when we look at neurodegenerative disease, which are all these different aspects or diseases that I just spoke about, this is kind of what you see. Are all these emotion dysregulations coming together and presenting themselves in these different brain injuries or illnesses? Interestingly, when we talk about traumatic brain injuries, so again, not sport-related concussions, but traumatic brain injuries, we see an elevation of these same four issues. So when you talk about depression, you're thinking the inability to regulate mood. When we think about anxiety, one of the highest and most common are generalized anxiety. So we're not talking about OCD or fear of elevators, we're talking about generalized anxiety overall. So it kind of is a little bit more generalizable to the populace. Impulsivity is most closely related with suicidality, however, it deals with a lot of other things. If you guys give Impact or Axon, they have the go, no-go tasks where they show something flashing at you and they're either supposed to hit the space bar or not. That's kind of testing some of their disinhibition abilities. And then aggression. And what we see with aggression is typically, at least in males, elevation in physical aggression, anger, and hostility, whereas females tend to usually be higher in verbal aggression. And this is sometimes like across the board for normal, but especially so in individuals who have sustained a traumatic brain injury as well. If you think about play, and if you're dealing with the kids that are knee-high to a grasshopper all the way up to the highest professional level of any sport, not only are they bigger and stronger and faster, but they've played for many more years, they've sustained many more injuries, their bodies are not nearly as elastic. I don't know how many five-year-olds you deal with, but they can fall off this stage and it looks like they should have broken something, but they're basically like Gumby and they just fold up weird and they get up and they run off. If I did that, I would definitely break something at this point, especially in heels. I don't have very good balance anymore. So as you age, things change. The brain also changes. When you're really young, Your brain is still developing, so that's why injuries take much longer for us to recover from. When we're older, about our mid-20s is when our brain finally settles down and gets to where all the neuropathways are set in stone. So it's not trying to seek that out anymore, which is usually why adults are able to return from concussion much more quickly than youth. The younger you are, the longer it usually takes because you're still trying to find a lot of those pathways still. But the risk of injury is going to increase, and part of that is if you think about ankle injuries and you say, all right, I've sprained my ankle once, am I probably going to sprain it again? More than likely, yes. Your brain is the same way. The more often that you impart impacts, whether subconcussive or concussive, the more likely you are to get another concussion. And the older you are, the longer you play, the more likely you are to sustain a concussion as well. This is a theoretical model that I've developed over time and kind of looking at the research, and kind of what the gist of it is looking at baseline status. Before you ever play a sport or fall off a swing set or whatever it is you're going to do when you're little, you are going to have your baseline status, genetics, your mood, your impact history, whatever you've been playing. And as you grow and as you progress, this is going to change. And then eventually, and what people think, is that you can potentially go through all these different pathways and end up getting to neurodegenerative disease from playing sports, specifically CTE, or maybe changing your odds or the prevalence or the instance of when it's going to happen in your life with Alzheimer's disease. Now, the black arrows on here have all been supported by both traumatic brain injury research as well as sport-related concussion. The gray, only through traumatic brain injury, and then the white are things that we still haven't even started looking at very much, and the red is really what I'm mostly interested in, and I'll speak quite a bit about today. So when you think about this area, and I will tell you right now, I am maybe the only or one of the few that are looking at these changes. So I thought, as we're looking at this, does it really matter if you play sports? Do these moods or behaviors or emotion dysregulation, does this actually change if you participate in a sport? And so I took a group of football players and I tested them at the beginning of the season with an aggression measure and with an impulsivity measure. And then I tested them again at the end of the season. And what I found were that the football players as a whole, not the individual in people, but as a whole, their scores for physical aggression, anger, and hostility all increased over the course of the season. And this is without respect to the number of impacts that they took, their age, if they were starters, none of that was included, only just football players. The average change of these three were 3 points on a scale that's from about 30, well, technically from 39 to 145. So I hope you guys would all look at me and say, what's 3 points? Technically, from a clinical standpoint, not very much. And so when you think about this, and this was talked about a little bit this morning, when we think about environment, if you are in a football environment, what does that mean to you? Are they a little bit aggressive, maybe? Maybe more than at least tennis, right? So they are rewarded for being aggressive on the field, doing all these different things. If you're in an environment that is always pushing you to be better, to lay out more, to be more aggressive, it's highly probable that what you do on the field is going to change your behaviors off the field as well. And this is kind of what these sort of indicate with what we're seeing, because the questionnaire doesn't have anything to do with what are you doing on the field, what are you doing in the weight room. They have to do with everyday life questions. Well then, when we think about these football players, if it's increasing over one season 3 points, well, 3 points might not be very significant clinically in 1 year. Remember, these are snapshots, right? 1 year. How many of your football players have been playing since they were 6, 7, 8 years old? So by the time they're seniors in high school, they've been playing already for more than 10 years. That's a 30 potentially point increase in their aggression. I would say 30 points is a significant clinical difference in individuals. And depending upon when they start, then this is something we need to consider. And this, I'm not saying that that really happens, and there might be some ebb and flow in this, and we certainly do expect for aggression to increase over the course of a lifetime, particularly with males, since they tend to be a little bit more aggressive anyway. But if this is what we see, and they're saying that in CTE and a lot of these people, they're developing these changes because of the football impacts, it might actually be because of the football exposure as well. So the environment is something really important. From a clinical aspect, also think about if their moods are changing over the course of a season, even if it's not a head injury, if they're getting hurt at the very beginning of the season versus the end, they might react very different to that injury depending upon the timing of the season. Think about the end of the season and how stressful it is if you're looking at playoffs. Or if you're looking at championship type of play and you do or don't get in, depending upon how they react, it'll be different. And then, I guess I already talked about that. We're good. So then the next thing I wanted to look at is, well, maybe this is only with respect to football. Maybe football players are different from everybody else, and maybe at baseline there really truly are differences. So we started looking at all athletes. So over the course of 3 years, I worked with three different high schools, and I brought in quite a few, just over 1,050 students, and started doing preseason and postseason testing. I'm only going to talk about the preseason, though. And I broke them into males and females, three different levels of contact with their sport, which I'll show you in a little bit, and then divided concussion history into just yes, no. And then looked at aggression and impulsivity again, but I added an anxiety, a depression, and then also a stress measure. Because sometimes during the season, if you're in midterms or if you're in finals or if you had somebody in your life die or you just broke up with your girlfriend or you just got a brand new puppy, things might maybe change, right? And your stress level is going to go up and down. So we thought this might really be something good to kind of factor in. Well, and I really hate to say that this supports normative values. It hurts my heart a little bit because of the girls' side, not the guys. The guys were significantly more aggressive and impulsive than the girls. I think most people would agree with that. And sadly, most people would probably also agree with girls are more anxious and depressed than the guys. And this, I will tell you, follows the normative values. Basically, for the entire United States, from the age of 13 to about 55, these are the differences that we see. After that, they kind of tend to meld back together. But this is the age group of all of our athletes. So from a clinical standpoint, I think it's important to think about when you're treating people that there's going to be differences at the onset, even at the beginning of the season, regardless of injury. Then we divided them up into different contact levels, high contact, so your collision type sports, low contact, and then no contact sports. And what we found were that the high contact sports were significantly more impulsive than the low and the no contact sports. And I would hope that that doesn't really jump out and surprise anybody in the room. When we look at anxiety, though, the no contact sports had significantly higher anxiety scores than the other two contact levels. And initially I was like, that's weird. I didn't really think there would be differences. But if you think about what types of sports and what types of athletes play these sports, you're looking at all individual sports in these no contact, right? So if you're playing tennis, win or lose, it's on you. If you're swimming, unless you're in a relay or in track, everything you do is on you. So the thought about this is there could be an issue, and I'll talk a little bit about it in a second, about the difference between bias selection of the athletes. Then when we divide them up into concussion history, athletes with a concussion history, not who just sustained a concussion, but it had one a year or longer, had significantly higher depression, as well as aggression and impulsivity compared to athletes who had never sustained a concussion. And these are high school kids. The range of concussions in this group, sadly, was from 0 to 9. And those were diagnosed concussions. Some of them told me in confidence that they had sustained several more than what they reported, but they hadn't been diagnosed, so they didn't think it needed to be reported. Thanks. I actually want to know about those too. But so I think that this is important to think about as clinicians, whom you're dealing with and what their background is. So the take home from these are that sex differences do exist. Even a baseline, without respect to concussion history, there are going to be differences. So when you're dealing with people, and understand that concussion immediately will change these scores. They're going to exacerbate them even more. So if males are already more aggressive and impulsive, they're going to be even more so after a head injury. Same with females with the depression and anxiety. These will continue to be exacerbated. And this is something we need to think about and how it's actually returning to zero. Are they getting back to those same levels before we allow them to get back on the field again? As far as the contact levels are different, I kind of alluded to this a second ago, but if you're going to think about these, and this is something that we still need to work on, it could be that people who are more impulsive or more anxious are drawn to these different types of sports. Or it could be, again, going back to the environmental aspect, where if you continue to participate in these sports, that children over time develop these differences in their emotion dysregulation or their mood states. And so I think this is something we need to look at and start looking at youth and then follow them over time to see if they develop because of the sports or if they really already were different at their younger ages. So then we go back to this, and I think impact biomechanics. Most of our concussions occur in sports where you're going to see contact of some sort occur. Very rarely do you see an athlete fall on their butt and give themselves a concussion. I've seen it maybe once ever. Most of the time it's because they're hitting their head on someone or something, right? So if we can look at impact stuff, when you think about it, and if you guys are reading these papers, there's a couple terms that are important to understand. When you talk about the number of impacts, they talk about frequency. When you talk about linear, so straight ahead acceleration or rotational acceleration, and you can rotate in the three different planes, so I'm not very good with boat terms, but like yaw and all those things, right? So side to side and no. Those are gonna be referred to as magnitude. Impact location. Most of these record impact location as front, top, back, and then side. Some of them record right and left side differently, and some of them just report side together. And then duration of the impact. So if you think about duration, and this plays into some of the ways that different companies have talked about modifying helmets and how you can put the Guardian on and some of the other things, you want your impact to be as short as possible. The longer the duration, the longer those forces are being imparted, and usually the greater damage you're going to be having. So if you can have it be fast with those hard helmets and they slide, usually you're going to see better outcomes. Most of the studies I'm going to talk about, or all of them, are going to deal with the magnitude and the impact location. When we think about methods, what I really thought about are football players, because this is where we see most of the issues occurring is in football. However, I will say right now, and you guys all know, concussions happen in all sports. Males, females, I've treated swimmers and fencers and golfers, you name it, but they happen all the time. They were also given the same preseason concussion history and emotion dysregulation scales, and then we were looking at their impact biomechanics. For this particular study, what we saw were that the athletes had higher anxiety, but this higher anxiety actually led to a lower risk of top of head concussion or top of head impacts, which I thought was really interesting, as well as lower rotational magnitude. Interestingly, higher aggression did the same thing. Now, understand that these are competition impacts only. And then higher depression actually had the opposite effect, and it raised how hard those impacts were. So there can be a lot of reasons behind this, of which I can't give you solid reasons for, but my thought is potentially that when we think about protective versus deleterious mechanisms, anxiety and aggression from this study seem to be protective, whereas depression seems to be a negative. And potentially, and this is my explanation, and we're going to try to look at this a little bit more, is that people who are more aggressive might also have lower anxiety, and these people are potentially the starters. They're on the field a lot more. Now you would think, well, maybe that's going to raise some things, but if you think about your starters, what is their technique like compared to their backups? In some schools, there is a huge drop-off from your first team to your second, right? Some you're pretty fortunate and they're close and you can interchange, but in a lot of them, there's a big difference. So if you're gonna look at their skill level, it can potentially be that these people are more skillful, and so that's why we're seeing these differences compared to some of the other athletes. With the depression, again, I'm not nearly as clear with that, and my suppositions would be less solid than even what I just said, so I'm just gonna leave that one alone for right now. When we talk about video, nobody ever wants to tackle video doing this stuff. If any of you guys have been football coaches or worked with the football coaches in video breakdown, you know that hours and hours go into this. Every game in a high school, if you wear head impact sensors, averages between, for a whole team, mind you, between 600 and 850 impacts. Our average number is about 700, 725 per game. This is for the whole team. And so what we can do is if people get concussions, we can start looking at concussion history and can we identify the impacts. In addition to that, we can start comparing them and these impacts to some of the emotion dysregulation changes that we're seeing. From player position, and this is especially true in high school, just because it actually says that 52 is a linebacker, does that mean he's always a linebacker? If you play in high school, he might play three or four different positions. As far as head impact biomechanics, that also plays into that. And I will let you know that our player positions, we decided to divide them up into three different groups, and we've actually found different things. So individual players, and we divide them into primary and secondary. So what do they play the most? And then kind of what do they play as their secondary or their second favorite? Then we look at general position and then player group. And again, depending upon your level in high school, a lot of them might play both, or you might really be able to allow them to specialize quite a bit. So when we looked at these, what we found in dividing them for body position was going to be really important in how we divide them up into these body positions when they're going into the actual impact. So what we looked at were, did they use their shoulders to drive through the impact? Did they use their hands or elbows, which we put together as arms? Were they leading with their head? And what was the position of their neck? And we turned it into a ratio because not all of the scores had the neck position that we were grading initially. And so just to give you an idea, this very top one that says best technique, if you have an individual, and I will let you know zeros are good. So if you have an individual who, I need to look at my thing, sorry. Who does not use their shoulders. So for instance, a running back, say. They have somebody coming from the side, a lateral impact. So they can't really drive with their shoulders, but they can put their hand out to protect themselves and they don't go into it bent down with their head and they're not driving through and they keep nice and neutral so they protect themselves when the impact comes. This would give them a superior score of a 0.25 because they would have a 1 divided by 4, you get a 0.25. Congratulations, that's really good because you really want a 0. However, some of you guys might have seen this before, if you have, say, a linebacker, and he's going to come into an impact where he's not going to use his shoulders. He's going to leave his feet. He is going to dive at a player with his head down, basically in a spearing position, maybe potentially get his hands into it, but mostly he's going to launch himself like a torpedo at somebody. This would earn you a 0.75 in our ratio because you didn't do pretty much anything right on the field and you're trying to break your neck. This is kind of how we graded things. This happens a lot. Running backs also do that a lot, but I decided to give a running back the good score for once. So when we looked at these, we used a lot of measures at the beginning and just kind of tried to divide them all up. And I will also let you know that we divided these individuals up into groups for magnitude. Lots of people, if you've read these studies, say 90 is really where it's at. I will let you know that in high school, very few impacts occur above 90 Gs. We've been doing research with high schools for several years now. They don't occur very often. Most of our concussions occur at 60 and just above. So for high school, we thought it was much better to lower this down to groupings much closer to that area. So that way, it would be much more representative of what we're really looking at. As far as I'm aware, only one concussion has only been reported below 60, and it was at 58 Gs. For those of you that don't understand G-force, if you're driving 10 miles an hour and you run into a brick wall, you hit the brick wall at about 10 Gs. So that's kind of how you think about it, okay? So what we found were that there were some differences in these groups, and what you can see are on these measures, and I hadn't shown it to you before, but this is the number of questions available and the possible range are participant scores. So notice you can go up to 145, and somebody got all the way to 110 on their aggression score. The highest is 120 for impulsivity, up to 80. 21 for anxiety, they were at a 15, and 27 for depression, and somebody was at a 22. Now, the averages were not nearly that high. So this shows you that most people were really on the low end. But I think that, again, this drives home that you're going to have people that are going to be all over the board on these. So understanding where people are at on your teams, whether it be males or females, is important. So when we looked at our results, what we found were that higher aggression and lower anxiety resulted in higher linear acceleration. And this was for the whole impact, not just only for competition like I was talking about before. And that anxiety, higher anxiety, was associated with lower odds of the impact falling in a higher area. So lower anxiety, again, appears to be something that's hopefully good. And so when we think about this and we're talking about impacts, I think that it's really important to think again about your aggression and what you're thinking about. The other thing that I need to point out is people are like, 1G, who cares about 1G? Most of our football players in these studies have, on average, between 300 impacts that the HIT system records a year, all the way up to about 1,700. So if you're talking about a 1G increase for 1,700 impacts, that's 1,700 extra Gs per 1 point increase in aggression. So if somebody scores 50 points higher than somebody else, I will let you do the math, but that is a big, big difference and the types of stresses that they're applying to their brain by having these differences in their scores. And when you think about what types of plays we're allowing them to be in, hopefully most of the people in the room understand that your higher magnitude plays are usually your special teams plays, right? Kickoffs, punts, where people are running from really long distances and they're impacting one another. So if you know somebody's really high in aggression, they might be good at it, but they also might really increase their risk for head injury and changing negatively their long-term outcomes. So this is something I think that can really help from a clinical side and potentially help inform coaches who may or may not be involved in certain types of plays. And this just kind of talks a little bit about how we're changing our plays and how these different things lead into how as clinicians we should really think about this. And with, again, emotion dysregulation, nobody's really using this at preseason, and I think we still need to do a little bit of research still, but I think that once we can get some of these normative values, that this will be helpful. The other thing that I think, and some of you may or may not agree with me, is that if you have athletes and you have artists, that their levels, baseline levels of aggression, impulsivity, anxiety, and depression are probably not going to be the same, even maybe before they ever played sport. So if we compare these individuals, I think we really need to compare them to a new normative score for these individuals. So when people talk about the NFL being this crazy aggressive score and they're doing all of these things, well, they might very well have been significantly different than normative scores from the get-go. That's why they made it to the NFL, right? Not everybody's gonna get there. So from there, a couple other cool things that we've done are looked at body position, head impact, and linear magnitude. And what we found were that the top of the head impacts were significantly higher than the face mask impacts. What does that tell you in coaches? If you don't want to get hurt, don't lead with your head. How many of your running backs do coaches tell, tuck the ball and go into an impact? They might not actually teach them that, but that's what they think they're supposed to do, and that's what they all do. Linebackers do the same thing. And again, these are video-confirmed impacts. One of the other things that I want to point out is almost 50% of the impacts were thrown out because they couldn't be confirmed on video, i.e., they weren't done in active football. This means they were on the sideline, the play was already done, or my favorite are your friendly fire impacts, like you did an awesome job, and then it's like rapid fire gunfire on somebody's head as they smack it as hard as they can. So they try to actually hurt their friends without trying to hurt their friends. I actually have video of people giving their teammates concussions from hitting them from doing a good job. It happens, it's dumb. So keep that in mind. I really try to get that down, especially the coaches from hitting people on the head. The other thing is right and left side seem to be different in how hard these impacts are, which I think is really different as well. As far as body position goes, and I hope this makes sense, people with the worst body position, so potentially worse skill level or they're not playing as well, have significantly higher odds of higher impacts than people who play with heads up, good position. So again, this goes back to if you use correct technique, you're probably going to be successful and you're going to lower your chances of injuring your neck or your head or whatever other body part you're hitting with. And so looking at these, I think that that's kind of one of the drive home points is the importance of heads up position. If people are playing with heads down position, and I'm sure you've seen it a whole bunch of times, where people go in to make a tackle, as soon as you lower your head, you can only see their feet. If you keep your head up, if they're gonna juke you, you can move with the juke. If you're not looking at them, you're probably gonna miss it, and or you're gonna go helmet to helmet and potentially knock yourself unconscious. So if you teach people, especially at an early level, how to play correctly, we're gonna lower the forces that we're applying to our brains and decrease our risk of injury. As far as training and interventions, you can also use this information to help inform coaches of who potentially really needs to have extra work done with them. And one of the things that we're really looking on are how we can integrate these emotion dysregulation information with the hits, so we can say these people are going to be far more likely to get much higher magnitude impacts. So if you spend extra time with them on the field, 10 minutes a week, something like that, especially when they're young, potentially they're not going to be getting hurt. So that means your wins, especially if they're a quality player, are going to go up. The kid's not going to get hurt. And again, we're improving their quality of life in the long term because they're not going to have to deal with multiple concussions or other injuries. The closing distance, I think, is something that hopefully won't really be that surprising to anybody. I love this example right here. So, oh gosh, it went. What's happening? I'm going the wrong way. Hold on. So, this guy right here, these are 7-year-olds on their kickoff. I don't know that we maybe need to change kickoff quite that close in any other level, but this is the NFL. So the NFL has already changed their distance, right? And when we talk about our close closing distances versus, you know, sometimes longer, if you're gonna waylay the mascot, particularly for the Buckeyes, I apologize because I know that we have a speaker, but I went to Iowa and Penn State, so I can't help it. But when we look at these types of things, I think this is important. So what we found were that, not surprisingly, long distance impacts were much higher magnitude than short distance impacts. In addition to that, the body position was significantly worse in long distance impacts. And when we bring in this emotion dysregulation information, again, I think that we can use this to help inform individuals and coaches into what types of plays people should be participating in, because if they're already at a greater risk to sustain higher magnitude impacts, and we know that long distance plays lead to worse body position, and both of these lead to higher magnitude impacts, then probably we shouldn't be putting these people at an elevated risk by adding those types of plays to what they already have going on. So when we look at these distances, again, worse body position, more severe head impacts, the worse you get. So with rule changes, I was kind of saying with the 10-year-olds, you know, potentially looking at moving kickoff points even a little closer than what they already are, or changing what's happening. One of the things that people don't do, and there was a study of officials, how often they penalize offensive players for spearing. Does everybody in here know the rule for spearing, like what spearing actually is? I had a football player in college tell me that spearing was something I made up. I was like, oh my God, you play football. All right, so it's bad that you play football and you think I made up the word spearing. But, so you can actually spear as an offensive player. I hope everybody knows that. It's the action, not what side of the football you're on. The officials admitted that they were maybe 1% of the time that they saw an offensive player spear somebody that they would throw a flag. Has anybody ever seen an official throw a flag for an offensive spearing? One. You are the winner. Chicken dinner. Good for you. That guy needs a golden star. So it almost never happens. How many of you actually have seen an offensive player spear, though? Hopefully, most of you should raise your hand. I've seen it lots and lots of times. So thinking about rule changes, educating, making people understand what's important and how we're going to help people, and then really emphasizing proper body position, especially in our youth, because how many people are going to learn something new or change their status when they're 20? Not very many, or when they're 30. But if you can teach them how to do it correctly when they're 5 and 6 and 7, or even when they're 12, you're going to have much, much better outcomes with these kids than trying to do it once they're older and they're playing at higher, more competitive levels. So this kind of brings me back to this linear progression. And if you think about it, and one of the things that you might ask is, Missy, do you really think that this is just straight across? You go to point A and then point B and then point C, and then you end up over here all the way at the end. And I've really thought about this a lot, and in looking at what our results have kind of shown, and I kind of said this before, if people play for 10 years, how do we see this change? And what I really think is that it's more of a cyclical progression, where you come in before you ever play sports and you have a certain set point. And then from there, you're exposed to sports and you may or may not incur head injuries, or you might fall on the ice, or you might fall out of your bunk bed, or you might get in a car accident. And then you're going to change your set point. And as you go over time, we continue to see these progressions. And I think as clinicians, that if we start incorporating some of these measures, we can maybe talk about, okay, so you're not returning to baseline on several of these, and maybe we should be holding you out for this season or for a year, or maybe we should talk about going to non-contact sports. Because if we're thinking that these are really correlated with and changing people's long-term outcomes in their life and their quality of life, as clinicians, since that's what we're concerned about, right, is their health, physical and mental, that this is maybe something that we should be incorporating in with what we're doing. So as far as take-home points, emotion dysregulation pretty much does not exist in sport-related concussion, only really in traumatic brain injury groups. And this is something that we're really trying to improve. And as a plug for what I'm doing, just so you know, I just took a job at Texas State, like you just said. So if anybody's interested in starting to work some of these in with my studies, talk to me at some point in time while we're here, and because I'll be moving here in August. Well, not here, but San Marcos. Aggression does increase. And we're looking at this so far with male sports, and we're starting to start running analyses for a lot of the other sports that we've been looking at. So sport and the environment seems to be an issue, but as I already said, so do contact, so do concussion history, so do sex. And so looking at these, I think that there's divisions, and as clinicians at baseline and then after injuries, it's something really important for you to keep in mind. As far as head impact biomechanics, heads up. As parents or as coaches or athletic trainers, talking to the coaches, making sure that they know what they're doing. There is no coaching certification to coach a 5-year-old. If there is, I need to figure out where that is and start making sure that we mandate that for everybody. Because any dad or fan can coach little kids, right? All the way through professional levels. So they might teach them old school football, or like that terrible television show that was on where the kids were going helmet to helmet, knocking themselves unconscious for all the world to see. Those kinds of things need to be changing. And if we can change it in the little kids, hopefully we're gonna see much, much better outcomes. And hopefully we can use some of this stuff to really inform rule changes and how our officials and our coaches are really doing what they're doing with their athletes. That pretty much wraps it up.